ground. It was a mole in the ground, and it root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
To KBOO Portland and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Natasha with Lauren Mercier, your host today for the Old Mold Variety Hour, where each Monday morning
we provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer today. The Old Mold burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Today's show focuses on how another world and city might be possible through exciting social movements that are challenging the way cities connect to the internet, the ways in which city resources are distributed, and to what ends, and how youth activists are leading the way to halt carbon emissions and slow climate change. Bill Resnick speaks to data engineer Michael Hanna, volunteer campaign manager for the Municipal Broadband PDX campaign, and activist with the Municipal Broadband Coalition of America, about how municipal broadband, which we could bring to Portland, is cheap, democratic, forces firms to compete, and can preserve net neutrality. I talked to Kumar Rao, senior staff attorney for racial justice at the Center for Popular Democracy, about invest-divest campaigns in cities across the country that give communities a voice in local funding decisions and support investments in supportive services and divestment from policing. And finally, Desiree Helligers brings voices from the June 4th downtown rally, at which more than 1,000 people turned out in support of the landmark climate change lawsuit, Giuliana versus United States. Here is Bill Resnick with Michael Hanna.
Hi, Michael Hanna. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill, for having me on your show.
Michael Hanna describes himself as a data engineer, an alchemist, post-carbon economy trailblazer, and dreamer. He has worked with digital networks, natural networks, and human networks for his entire adult career. He is now campaign manager for the Municipal Broadband PDX campaign. He also directs the Municipal Broadband Coalition of America, which is growing rapidly. Municipal broadband is the topic of today. As to making a living, Michael Hanna is employed working for Multnomah County as a business intelligence architect, data engineer. For 6 years, he was president of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 88, that represents 3,800 Multnomah County workers, and that was in a period of extreme difficulty for the city and strife and struggle by the union. Michael, that bio demonstrates, at least to me, that you're one of those new Generation X millennial workers in technology to boot, also in politics, one of those folks who find major social change, call it transformation, the idea of radical democracy, as very attractive and possible and, of course, necessary. And that makes you and your fellow millennials the hope for the future.
But it's going to take all of us. It's going to take all of us bringing our best selves and our knowledge experience to the table.
And our intelligence and commitment. So, Michael, tell us about municipal broadband and the Multnomah County campaign.
Great. So I'll start with to say that publicly owned fiber optic internet utilities have been around. Municipal broadband, and now some people use the term community broadband, have been around for at least 20 years. One of the first in the United States was Chattanooga, Tennessee in 1999, and they installed a fiber optic network, and it's been hugely successful there. And since then, about 300, at least 300 communities in the United States have their own fiber optic internet utility of some sort in now, and it's growing. Our specific campaign here in Multnomah County began formally the night that net neutrality was repealed by the FCC. So in November of 2017, the FCC finally repealed net neutrality, and that really was the formal launch of our campaign, where we said the only way we're going to be able to have permanent net neutrality and have full control of our internet access is to have it ourselves, our own it ourselves, our community.
And not rule out left radical voices.
Allow, you know, net neutral means that the voices and the content and the flow of the information over the network is not throttled.
Yeah.
It's not throttled anyway. It's neutral in terms of the content. And that's a really key core value of the internet.
KBOOBY could be called extremist, especially this program. Tell us first, Chattanooga's fiber optic. What does that mean? What does it mean for the citizens? And how is it done? These are really fiber optic lines, right?
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So basically, the core backbone network of the world's internet runs over fiber optic cables. And the fiber optic cables go from state to state and country to country. And they go under the ocean. There's these transatlantic, transpacific cables that go. And they basically connect the world's, internet is runs on fiber optics. Now, when you get into connectivity to the home, most internet connections in the home today are either over the wired cable line, which is what Comcast uses to connect you to the internet, is the old cable lines, or the phone lines, which are the twisted pair copper phone lines that have been in decades in our homes. That's what CenturyLink uses to connect you to the internet over the copper lines. So what we're looking to do is run a new set of lines, fiber optic cables, all the way to the home.
All the way to the home. And so the people of Chattanooga, though, would then have to have a router or whatever it is in their home. Some kind of device that then...
Exactly. So it's basically the exact way it works today. Like today, if you have Comcast, you have a router that connects you to the internet at your home. Same with CenturyLink. If you're here, you have it over your phone lines. This would be a third type of connection to the home, which is a fiber optic cable. And it's literally a cable of glass that carries signals of light. So it's extremely fast and very high capacity.
And it picks up all of this stuff. If you Google the trillions and trillions of things that you can look at.
Yep, exactly.
It seems inconceivable, but I guess it happened, so I can't argue with it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The fiber optic cables have such amazing capacity to carry information, and that's literally, like I was saying, when United States is connected to Europe, for example, that connection between the United States and Europe runs over fiber optic cables, and all of the information that's transmitted over the internet back and forth is over these fiber optic cables.
From billions of sources.
Yep, yep. It's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing, but I guess it's technically, that's what the protons and all the, and the little atomic particles, a billion of them smaller than a hair or whatever it is, that's what they do or that you're harnessing. One thing, though, what about homes that don't have money for a router?
Yeah, so the whole thing that we're trying to do is create a community-controlled, and we can talk about that soon, about how that would be governed, but a community-controlled fiber optic network so that every home and business can have fiber optic cables all the way to their premises. And I think you touched on the affordability, and that's a really core driving factor for this, is that we want to make sure that everyone in our community has access. And so if certain households are low income, that would that access to the internet to the fiber optic network would be subsidized access. So no matter what, our goal is to have everybody in, nobody out, so that everyone has access. Currently in Multnomah County, almost 30% of low income households and elderly households do not have internet.
Oh, but 70% of people do already at homes. Now, that's paid for in a bill that goes to, I don't know who, Verizon, Comcast, somebody or other. The bill is pretty high, actually.
Most of the internet access today is profit. So the three primary home internet providers are Comcast, CenturyLink, and Frontier Fios, Frontier Internet. And most of their cost is most of the bill that we pay is profit to them. And most of that goes to out-of-state corporations, those three out-of-state corporations. And so in Multnomah County, it's an estimated $225 to $250 million a year that is actually sucked out of our local economy in profit. And so this is really about creating a local internet utility, community broadband internet utility, where we want to keep as much as possible of that money in the local economy. So it benefits local people and not these out-of-state corporations.
What would the subscription fee be that would go to the city as compared to how much we're paying to the big providers?
We won't know for sure until the feasibility study comes back. But fundamentally, the goal is that homes are paying the same or less than they're paying now, and for much better quality service. So there's no comparison. The best internet connectivity in the world is fiber optic networks. It's just the fastest, highest quality.
And that's not what we're getting now. Oh, we're getting it on these copper lines.
Yep, we're getting on these copper lines, exactly. And it's a metallic infrastructure, and the speeds can't compare to fiber optic speeds. Nothing compares to fiber optic speeds. And then also, you've got these wireless companies, like you mentioned, AT&T and Verizon, all these wireless companies that power our mobile phones that give us connectivity also, and they charge very high rates for very low quality service. And the wireless can never compare to fiber optics. Fiber optics is the world's best internet connection.
They would still have cell phones because you could carry a computer with you, right? Some of these things are, a cell phone can be essentially a computer now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on. I mean, it's the technology is all converging where it really is just, you know, these phones are just mini computers.
But with the phone, with the cell phone, it would not be connected by wire. So, but would it be would it pick up the internet then as the person was pathetically watching it while they're sitting in a lecture taught by some friend of mine? It's very discouraging when you have all of your students looking at these damn things. Are they going to be able to do that?
Yeah, well, the wireless devices, the cell phones, and all the addiction of these devices—that's a whole other conversation.
You're talking about home, and that would be another. But it probably could ultimately, at some point, fit in and also lower the bill that way. If people want to live that kind of life of being always connected everywhere at every second.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Michael Hanna, who is the campaign manager for Municipal Broadband PDX. He also directs the Municipal Broadband Coalition of America. He's here talking about municipal broadband and its many advantages. We've talked about just the money advantage, the speed advantage, and a lot of the complications at lesser cost. There's also the advantage of the money stays in the community rather than going to Goldman Sachs and the big banks. Michael, there is opposition, and they say, how can you justify putting something under the management of the state? They're completely incompetent and ineffective, and they'll run everything into the ground, whereas private industry is innovative and wonderful, and even they're the entrepreneurs who developed this technology, which, of course, is utterly absurd. It was the technology came out of government grants and military grants to small little people who did some of the technicians who did the work. The internet and the computer are a product of good investments by the state. But that's what they say. How do you deal with that issue? We can't afford to have the state take over such an important function.
Yeah, well,
that's what they say. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great topic of discussion. So if we went back 100 years ago, almost the exact same discussions were happening around electricity and water. So most of our electricity and water was privately owned in America 100 years ago. And the same exact arguments were happening. Oh, we can't trust our government to run our utility, our electric, our water. It's such critical infrastructure. Well, I would argue that our connectivity, our internet connectivity, is now our critical infrastructure for the 21st century. And so just like we had to transition to publicly owned water and electricity or regulated utilities like Portland General Electric, we eventually
highly regulated monopolies.
Highly regulated monopolies.
Yeah, who are not who it seems to me though have captured the regulators. That's another problem.
Right. That's where with the internet connectivity and the internet utilities, I think we have 100 years of history to draw from, and we want to do it differently in the internet world.
No one wants private water utilities. And there's a few places that did it and then reversed.
Yeah,
quickly they had to reverse the because those people want to make money. They then raise rates and they invest only in rich neighborhoods. What are you?
Exactly. And we recognize that with the water, the flow of water. And so we're now in this transition where we're recognizing that with the flow of information. Same kind of thing.
Right.
Where we want to have free flow of information that is regulated in a way that benefits the community.
Yeah.
And that's really what we're trying to do.
How would the system become accountable? And the private companies, of course, are not accountable, except to some extent through the contract that gets negotiated through people that they contribute money to and control in other ways. The city mothers and fathers want to keep the companies happy. Michael, talk about accountability. How do we ensure that they're accountable?
Yeah, so I think you make really key points about corporate power and corporate control and elected officials. And there's many different models of how we can do community broadband. But the model that I'm personally in favor of is a hybrid model where the physical infrastructure, in this case, it's the fiber optic cables and the network equipment, the physical infrastructure is publicly owned and it's owned as a utility and it's just kind of a public good. And then the services that are run over that network are private for-profit services, but it's a very controlled access way. So from the physical network, we have our elected officials and we can have citizen oversight and, you know, accountability of that network. And then we can also set the values that we're trying to set within our network of who runs the services. So if the service is internet access or streaming digital television or voice phone access or new emerging services like telehealth, where you can have live video conferencing with your doctor, these services would be run by for-profit companies and they're held accountable, where if they don't perform, they can be kicked off the network. And you can have a community review of those services on periodic intervals. And really, that's core of how this is so different from corporate controlled, where corporate controlled, for example, Comcast, they own the network and they own the service, and there's really almost zero accountability.
And there's no net neutrality, is
yep.
there?
Yep, no net neutrality.
You began with that early on. They yep. can cut off whoever they want, and apparently the Supreme Court thinks that that's, of course, accurate.
Yep, and that's where we can build into our network the rules that we want to have from that day one. For example, we can say permanent net neutrality forever on our network, that we will not throttle the content on the network. We can also build in privacy rules so that we really protect the privacy of residents and businesses, which is another thing in the corporate networks. Our data, our browsing history, everything is mined by these corporations and then resold because that data has value.
Right. And you can't have privacy rules. You have the last, you're going to get the last word, Michael, although I reserved the opportunity to say something.
Sure.
Okay. I'm talking to Michael Hanna, who directs the Municipal Broadband Coalition of America. And important to us, he's the campaign manager for the Municipal Broadband PDX campaign, which has a feasibility study going all over. It's probably going to say this would be good for you. How do we win it, though? It's one thing to get a good feasibility study. It's another to actually implement the system.
Yeah. So it's all about community organizing. organizing, really. At the end of the day, if our community wants this, we have to organize and push for it. And the feasibility study, as you said, that'll look at the economics of it, the technical challenges, the issues about building this out. But really, it's about what does the community want? And when the feasibility study comes back, we have to be organized as a community and say, if we want this for our community, we have to push for it as a community. Also, there's the chance of sending it to the ballot for a vote of the public. And that's been done in multiple cities. Fort Collins, Colorado did that. It went to the ballot and the residents voted overwhelmingly to support a public community broadband.
You know, that's likely to happen, isn't it? Indeed, the city council here in Multnomah County or whoever, the various municipalities that would have to vote, they all may decide they would prefer to have a county referendum. Can a county do a referendum as well? I guess it can, yeah.
Yep.
That they would rather, or a city initiative or whatever, the various ways of doing it. They may also just kick the can, which is good. Then you have the discussion of it. And the companies aren't going to come in with billions of dollars. This is have to be a grassroots campaign.
Yep, exactly. Because the three main internet companies now in Portland Metro, Comcast, CenturyLink, and Frontier, they would stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of years, and they're going to fight it every way they can. But really, this is about our community and what do we want as a community. And whatever we do here will affect our community and our connectivity, the digital infrastructure, for decades. And so we really want to design this right and do what's right for our community.
How do they contact the Municipal Broadband Coalition?
So we have a website. It's www.municipalbroadbandpdx.org. That's one option. Also on Facebook, we are Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at PublicNetPDX.
PublicNetPDX. But you can also get you just by Googling, right?
Yep.
If you forget that, you just...
If you just Google
Municipal Broadband PDX, Portland PDX,
you can find us.
Wind up getting a way of getting even more detail. Michael Hann, it's been great talking to you today. Keep up your many, wear your many hats with distinction.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Natasha. We just heard from Bill Resnick and Michael Hanna, who told us about the many advantages of municipal broadband. And we have another guest who will tell us about ways in which we can reprioritize public assets for the common good. Kumar Rao is senior staff attorney at the Center for Popular Democracy, where he helps manage its racial justice policy work and supports partner organizations in their campaigns around racial equity, criminal justice, and the movement for Black lives. Welcome to KBOO, Kumar.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, last month, many Portlanders were disappointed that the city council voted down Commissioner Joanne Hardesty's proposal to shift funds from the police bureau and its gang enforcement team to parks and recreation. But if we in Oregon and Washington states want to reprioritize spending from punitive to supporting systems, we have a lot to learn from what other cities have been doing with their budgets. And Kumar, you're one of the co-authors of the report, Freedom to Thrive, Reimagining Safety and Security in Our Communities. Tell us about some of the key findings about the impacts of increased spending on criminalization, policing, and incarceration over the past three decades.
Sure. Well, yeah, thank you again for having me. And yeah, we were watching closely what was happening in Portland, and though we were, you know, disappointed with the outcome, really wanted to feel encouraged that these fights are happening, that the narrative is beginning to shift. I think we're going to start seeing some real changes happen around our country. But to sort of start from where we began, we put out a report a few years ago, as you mentioned, and really examined what we were doing as a country when it came to spending on our limited resources. We know that we live in countries and in cities where we don't have unlimited access to money and really need to be stewards and moral stewards of our public resources. And what we found in our report was that in city after city, our budgets actually reflected a very kind of perverse sort of sense of what were priorities. As a nation, we're spending upwards of $200 billion a year on policing and jails. And actually, the vast bulk of that money is being spent at the local level. In city after city, we found that anywhere from a third to over half of the general funds in a city were going exclusively to policing and to police departments. And in discussion and deep solidarity and conversation with activists and organizers and residents in these cities, what we heard was that people really felt that it was other types of investments and resources that were getting shortchanged, the types of things that would actually allow communities to be safe and to allow them to thrive, whether that was jobs and housing and healthcare or our youth or even just infrastructure. The kinds of things that would really allow communities to be safe were being shortchanged. And so through this report and through the work of our organization, you know, we're really trying to support a shift in the way we think about public safety and for that to be reflected in budgets and to really start moving, you know, the billions and billions of dollars a year that are just flowing endlessly to police departments, to corrections, to jails, to sheriffs, to the entire kind of mass criminalization, mass incarceration infrastructure, towards the kinds of things that we know our communities desperately need.
And along with those spending increases to policing and criminalization, there are decreases in budgets to, as we saw in Portland, to Parks and Recreation and other human services. So despite the evidence that all this increased spending on policing does not make cities safer, why do cities and counties continue to rely overwhelmingly on policing and incarceration spending while under-resourcing more effective safety initiatives?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of factors, but, you know, ultimately, and then this is the crisis we find ourselves in as a country, but just the vision that the way to advance and enforce public safety is through punitive measures. This isn't how it's done around the world. There's a lot about the United States that we know that, you know, makes us different, whether, you know, it's how we administer healthcare or our priorities at the federal level on the military. It's a vision that we are going to kind of use punitive measures and punishment to affect behavior versus really just investing in communities. There's a legacy here going back probably centuries in terms of the racial dynamics and the sort of white supremacist kind of ideology that is at the core of a lot of this sort of perspective. And ultimately, you know, it's big business, it's big money. The forces that I think are maintaining the status quo or even making it worse as it relates to mass criminalization, over policing, are very powerful political interests. And for a long time, I think they have put the fear of God, in a sense, in elected officials, have really squashed activism and organizing, and I think have fed sort of a false narrative in the media and in the public consciousness that anytime you even remotely suggest that we should rethink our spending on policing or on jails, that somehow you are anti-police or you are anti-public safety, when in fact what we're talking about is actually a pro-safety type of initiative. What we're really talking about is trying to make communities safe in the long run and to allow them to be stable and prosperous. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing I think we really need to fracture. I'll just mention briefly that we are at the Center for Popular Democracy, and along with many of the partners that we've been working with, such as Law for Black Lives and BYP 100, and now the National Council of Incarcerated Women and several other organizations, are in the middle of developing a campaign to actually attack this issue at the federal level, and the target being the 1994 crime bill, which kind of put a federal and in some ways liberal imprint and endorsement of punitive measures like policing and prisons as the pathway to public safety. And so I think this issue and this kind of paradigm shift has to happen, you know, at the federal level, at the state level, the municipal county level, and as, of course, at the local level. And so we see these as kind of all deeply tied and that we need to target all levels.
And there's some pretty exciting campaigns taking place across the country. Could you give us some examples of, well, cities like Durham or other cases where this kind of mobilization has really pushed city councils, city commissions, and metro governments to redirect their budgets towards more socially useful purposes?
Yep. There was a really exciting victory just a couple weeks ago in Durham, North Carolina. As you mentioned, one of our partners in our network within the Center for Popular Democracy called Local Progress, which is a network of progressive elected officials, including Jillian Johnson, who is the mayor pro tempore in Durham, actually led initiative and got a 4-3 vote in the 2020 budget against funding 18 new police officers, and actually took that money, that line item, and raised the wage for part-time city workers to over $15 an hour. So really sort of thinking critically about these requests for increased funding and to look strategically at other priorities in the budget to really invest in communities. There was a similar situation last year in St. Paul, Minnesota, as well as in Minneapolis, where elected officials really looked critically and declined to increase money towards the policing and invested it in parks and recreation or libraries or even more traditional public safety measures that were outside of the police department, such as domestic violence prevention programs through public education. So this is happening. We're still, I think, in a kind of early moment in some sense in terms of this happening, but I do think we're going to increasingly see cities realize that their fundamental interest is towards the public safety of communities and to be moral stewards of public resources. And the two of those really need to be thought to together, and we need to start making some shifts in how we do business for neighborhoods in this country.
And as you noted, the increases in funding for housing, for after-school programs for kids, for parks and recreation, for all kinds of other programs really does create more security. As you note, the more resources that we put into people rather than punitive measures, the more quality of life people have, the flourishing of the community. I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities once people realize they can make that shift. You know, the same kind of fear-mongering that is at the federal level in devoting just an enormous amount of resources into the military complex, the same we have at the local and state levels with these kinds of punitive expenditures that just really squeeze so much out of the resources available to a community.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think Jillian Johnson, as I said, from Durham, had a really great quote, which was basically that communities that are safest don't have the most police, they have the most resources. So really what we're talking about is that is to get our communities resources. That's going to lead to public safety. And so we are, I think, very excited at the prospect. As I said, although disappointed in Portland, I feel like that this is going to be back, I'm certain. And if we're really going to be pushing to make our community safer and stronger, it's going to really require, you know, additional resources into really the basic necessities of what our communities need: housing, healthcare, jobs, youth, education, and infrastructure.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Kumar Rao, who is a staff attorney for the Center for Popular Democracy. And Kumar, just in our remaining minute or so, tell listeners how they might become more aware of resources available to help with organizing and committing our own community to this more valuable use of local resources.
Absolutely. So I would absolutely encourage everyone to check out and join the listservs at the Center for Popular Democracy. We are developing a set of campaigns and supporting organizing around the country for groups that are interested in pushing for this agenda, as I said, alongside many partner organizations, as well as we developed a toolkit, which I think some of your listeners may be interested in, through our local progress network. That's at a website called reformtransform.org, and really offering a way to evaluate where cities are on this issue of public safety and their budgets, and to really start to give folks tools to analyze what the priorities are in your city. How much is your city spending on policing? How much is it a percentage of the total budget? How much has that changed over time? You know, how does that compare to spending for affordable housing, jobs programs, mental health, and youth development? And to really sort of offer a way for people to compare and evaluate how their cities are, and to compare that really against other places to see how we are doing across this country. So I would, again, that's reformtransform.org.
Okay. Well, Kumar Rao, thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll post links to that toolkit and the populardemocracy.org websites. Thanks so much. Now, Desiree Helligers brings audio highlights from the June 4th rally in Pioneer Courthouse Square in support of the Children's Trust climate justice lawsuit, Juliana versus United States. The landmark case being argued in front of the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit asserts the youth plaintiff's right to an habitable planet, and that the plaintiffs are being deprived of their rights to life, liberty, property, and public trust resources by federal government acts that knowingly destroy, endanger, and impair the unalienable climate system that nature endows. City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty opens the rally.
One of the things that old folks like me forget is how often young people have led movements in this country. Every single one has been led by young people that have drawn a line in the sand and said, no way, no more, not in my name. Know that I am so proud, A, to be a part of this fabulous gathering, and B, to know that young people, as they have always done, will stand up when they get tired of hearing about our excuses about why we're not acting. They will stand up, they will be clear, and they will demand action. What do we want? Justice! When do we want it?
Yes.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Yes.
Love you all!
Thank you, Joanne, for standing in solidarity with the youth plaintiffs. We are going to now watch the live stream, and we will hear Julia Olson, Chief Legal Counsel for the 21 plaintiffs and their fight for climate recovery, argue against Jeffrey Clark, lawyer for the government defendants, as they try to deprive the youth of their constitutional rights to a climate system capable of sustaining human life. These arguments are expected to last approximately 45 minutes, so enjoy silk screening, meet with your friends, enjoy the art, and we'll get back together shortly. Now I'd like to acknowledge an amazing supportive community of faith in Portland that has come out in support of this case, Rabbi Benjamin Barnett of Havara Shalom.
How are we adjusting our lives and our impact on this world so that the children and grandchildren of this generation and of generations on will be able to survive and thrive on the earth? That question, that challenge is what I receive from my tradition and what I believe is asked of us from all spiritual traditions. It should not take our being called to task by our children's generation to have us recognize the consequences of our actions and inaction.
Robin White, an incredible Cheyenne Lakota artist. He's a native rights, environmental, labor, and human rights organizer who will lead us with a blessing. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, everyone. I picked this blessing because I think it's important that we realize that we do not have dominion over the earth. The Great Spirit and Unchimaka for the winged people, the finned people, and the four-legged people who give us housing, give us shelter, give us food, and give us companionship and beauty all around us. I especially thank them for the water. Nivichoni, water is life. It's our first medicine, our most important medicine. Great Spirit, thank you. Great Spirit, bless these people and their endeavors. And please help those judges make the right decision. Thank you.
Bill Gregory, co-counsel in the Giuliana lawsuit.
This is what democracy looks like. I believe there will be climate justice. It will be swift and it will be sure. There is so much at stake here. We definitely have a climate right capable of sustaining human life. That is what this court will find, and that is how we will all prevail. We must remember that it is our Constitution that the judges were looking at today, and they said there is convincing evidence of injuries. There's convincing evidence that this Congress, that this administration is doing nothing but putting the foot on the accelerator of fossil fuels. These violations require a science-based remedy, and that is why this case is ready to go to trial right now. Yeah. The evidence is clear. The science is unmistakable. We must go to trial, and these judges are going to let this case go to trial. And there's one force behind our trial team, one inspiration, who today put all of her knowledge, put all of her passion on the line. She's a remarkable lawyer. She's someone I am proud to serve as co-counsel with. Please, please give it up for Julia Olson.
We have an amazing legal team at our Children's Trust, and I can't tell you the number of hours that the whole team has put into making this possible. And we do all of this for these 21 young people, but also for all young people out there. All of you. And all generations to come. What I said to the court today is for them to dismiss this case, they'd have to find that in the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, you don't have a right to life or liberty. Personal security is out the window. Your family autonomy is gone. And truth and justice will prevail over the lies of the government in this case. And thank you so much for being here.
So next, I want to introduce one of the youth plaintiffs on this lawsuit, Levi. He's one of the youngest, or he is the youngest plaintiff on the Giuliana case. He grew up and he still lives on a small barrier island off of Florida. And he's going to tell us a little bit about how he got involved and what this case means to him.
Thank you. I am 11 years old and I turned 12 this summer. This case filed in 2016. A little after I turned 8. It's been 4 years since I got involved with this case. That's literally one third of my life that I have dedicated to this lawsuit, fighting for my future. I'm only 11 years old, and that means I still have a long time left to live on this planet. I have a long time left to deal with the consequences of climate change. And I am still a kid. My constitutional rights are being violated even more than older people who won't be around to see the effects of climate change. Woo! And we only have a little time left to put a science-based climate recovery plan into place. A plan that will return CO2 levels to less than 350 parts per million and limit global warming to 1 degree Celsius before it is too late. I live on a barrier island. That means I can go to the beach or see the sunset over the lagoon. I can watch dolphins, turtles, and manatees, and I can go barefoot all year round. It is a beautiful place to live. It's got the ocean on one side and the Indian River Lagoon on the other. It is only about a mile wide and sits close to the sea level. That means I am completely surrounded by water. When a hurricane is coming to Florida, they may announce a mandatory evacuation for my island. That means everyone on the island has to go someplace else. That means I have packed my favorite books, taped up the windows, sandbagged the door, and left. After sitting through the hurricane, we wait till the power comes back on and the streets are clear enough to return home, hoping everything will be okay. Hurricane season started on June 1st, and I have to think about the possibility of the same thing happening again. Storms are happening more often. Storms are getting more severe. Storms are producing more rain. And being almost at sea level, that means the risk of flooding is high. In fact, just a few weeks ago, it rained. Just a short little rainstorm. The street by my library was flooded up to my knees, and it wasn't even a hurricane. The Constitution says that I have a right to life, liberty, and property. How am I supposed to enjoy life, liberty, and property if one day the island that I live on will be underwater? That is violating my constitutional rights. I am just a kid who cares about where I live. I am just a kid who cares about what my future on this planet will be like. I am just a kid who cares about my constitutional rights. Thank you.
Now we have Vic Barrett from New York City. Vic is a fellow with the Alliance for Climate Education and an active climate movement organizer in his community. Vic focuses work on working on climate justice issues and has presented about these issues around the globe, including at the United Nations. Let's give it up for Vic.
What's happened here today and what's been happening with youth climate movements around the world is part of a larger narrative. It's a story that's going to exist throughout human times as the moments where we've decided what we are. What it is to be young is being redefined every day. It's always been a time of change and growth and discovery, and now it's all about that and more. It's about laying down the groundwork to ensure a healthy world. It's no longer just planting the roots of who you'll be, it's planting the roots of what our world will be, if it'll still really be our world. We spent another day in court facing our government, the apparent strongest government in the world, showing fear of young people and showing fear of facts. We're learning every day that we're the ones who must secure our future. We must do the work. We must take to the streets. Being young is being an activist today. And cheering each other on. So I want my two cents today to be dedicated to the youth who showed up, not just to the youth who are up here. Thank you for the sacrifices I know you're making every single day when you wake up, for the school days missed, for the moments on the bus where all of a sudden you're like, damn, climate change is a terrible issue. I just want to tell you, keep going even when it seems like you can't, when everything is telling you to stop, because we have all the power, we have all the tools, and we have all the stake in this issue. As long as we're reminding our leaders who they work for, as long as we keep screaming at them what we need, no one can ever tell us that we didn't do every single thing we can to ensure a future for us and our children. Thank you.
I have the pleasure of introducing the named plaintiff in the Giuliana lawsuit, Kelsey Giuliana herself, a leading voice in the burgeoning youth climate movement. Kelsey's been participating in climate activism since she was 10 years old.
This case is about all of us. This time is about all of us, and it is so much more. It is about fundamentally establishing stable climate system, a future, a livable future, a future of dignity as a constitutional right. It's about ensuring for my children and their grandchildren that they will be able to exist. As young people in this case, we rely on experts. We rely on experts who are willing to give their time, their devotion to us. In 1988, Dr. James Hansen testified in Congress about the critical, the dire effects of rising CO2 levels. Even though our federal government in 1965, they released a memo saying that if we don't really dramatically curb our carbon emissions, we can look at 10 feet sea level rise and apocalyptic reality. Now, 1988 was also the last year that we saw 350 as that stable marker of CO2 emissions in our atmosphere, which Levi talked about. We have only risen. It's 2019. We have been part of this litigation effort for 4 years now. We are at 415 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That has never been there in human history, and that is unacceptable. I've been doing this work since I was 10 years old. I'm 23 years old. We have until Levi, the youngest plaintiff in this case, is my age, to dramatically address climate change and get ourselves on climate stability track according to the IPCC. We are bringing this case in front of the justice branch because this case is about an incredible injustice that has prevailed in this country long before any of us and even our parents were born. But this case is about all of us branching together. We cannot be here if it's not for the grassroots movement. We cannot be here if it's not for the people that we are representing. Today in court, the defendant said that when faced with, and I quote, a direct threat to life, the appropriate response from the government of the United States, elected by, for, and of the people, is to just re-elect members, re-elect decision makers. So what I have to say to that is, you bet we will. Bet we will. And in the meantime, we're going to keep pushing this case forward, and we're going to keep thinking. We're going to keep thinking the other judges at all three levels of courts of the United States who are also seeing the necessary action of this case and the urgency of this case, and we're continuing to put this case forward. And we're going to keep on relying on you all to keep showing up and doing the work in your own communities and doing the work that is right to you, whether it be music or art or activism or writing or running for office yourself so I can elect you. Keep showing up, and we're going to do it together. Because what does democracy look like?
This is what democracy looks like. You've been listening to voices from the June 4th Portland rally in support of Juliana v. United States, the landmark Children's Trust climate justice lawsuit. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Olmo Variety Hour.
Thank you for listening to KBOO.
And the Olmo Variety Hour. We want to thank Desiree Helligers for that recorded piece from the June 4th Children's Trust Climate Justice Rally. Tomorrow, June 18th at Tabor Space, 6:30 to 8:30, the Climate Reality Project brings Kelsey Juliana and other youth activists for discussion. We also want to thank today for their contributions Bill Resnick, Michael Hanna, Kumar Rao, and Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. We heard music from Con Brio. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow up and contact us. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m.